This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We are exploring the science and scientists who warn us we are on the road to mass extinction. Dr. Jackson laments that species are dying off faster than we can discover and catalog them. Biology has descended into being an obituary of nature.
In summary, Nancy calls this the refining the obituary of nature, which is what I sometimes think 95% of conservation biology is, unfortunately. We are causing extreme habitat changes, which is causing reductions in entire suites of organisms to the point of ecological extinction. Who cares if they're extinct? They will be extinct. It's not worth trying to find out if they're extinct, because we'll never find most of them again. This elimination of all these things that we used to value is providing the opportunity for all sorts of new creatures on the block, which are going to increase in abundance whether we like them or not. The cow-nose ray is an example. All the seaweed on the reefs of the world is an example. All of those microbes that we don't like very much are examples. And of course, these newly established communities are really hard to get rid of. It's the Humpty Dumpty effect, you know? It's really easy to break an egg, and it's very hard to put it together again. And there are experiments being done now, which are probably the most exciting and important ecology that's being done in conservation ecology, to see whether or not you can overcome these thresholds to actually restore ecosystems to something vaguely like what they used to be. But I can tell you, it's not a particularly happy literature. Okay, so given all that, what are the projected long-term consequences of these changes for the environment and human well-being? And, you know, the Millennium Ecosystems Assessment is a wonderful thing. And I thought it was really cool that it had scenarios, but those scenarios are defined in terms of what we can imagine. And in my mind, that's what's wrong with those scenarios. Scientists are just really not good at sticking their necks out. It takes people like this to write books like Brave New World and 1984, right? And if you think about how 1984 was considered to be outrageous and how it's all true today, look at the White House. There's something to be gained from this. So at any rate, I think it's, don't you love that? To book to be read again and again and ponder before oblivion comes. Actually, the best, I don't know how many of you read The Time Machine, but if read it or reread it, it's wonderful because, you know, our hero advances forward in time and he goes to a time in the future where humans have evolved into two species, the Alloy and the Morlocks, and the Alloy are the effete former aristocrats who are basically farmed by the Morlocks, who are the working class living underground, and they eat the Alloy, you know, because people have eliminated all animals on Earth except for people, and so they have to breed people to eat them. And our hero escapes from the Morlocks in a very, very difficult situation and jumps in his machine and fast forwards and goes too far. And he gets to a time on the future Earth when the sun is bigger and there is nothing on the Earth but slime and a giant crab that almost devours him in his machine. And that's, we're going there. Okay. So the global ocean, you know, there used to be a lot of big animals, but we know what happened to them. And there used to be a lot of three-dimensional structure, and that hung on long enough for people like me and Paul to see it. And this is where we're going.
Then we get an explicit warning of mass extinctions.
We heard about mass extinctions, and I used to think, there was a wonderful meeting here 6 years ago on the future of evolution that was organized by Andy Knoll and Norman Myers, actually. And there was a lot of parallel in that meeting to the meeting we're having here. And I heard David and Doug at that meeting talk about the wisdom that we can derive from the fossil record. And I thought, you know, this is really interesting, but I don't think it has anything to do with what's going on now. I mean, we're going through something really terrible, but I don't see. But, you know, the Permian Triassic extinction, we're going there. I mean, I'm going to show you three scenarios. This is the one, this is the hopeful one. This is the best humanity can hope for. Now, you just think about how likely it is that we will cap and reduce nutrient runoff and carbon emissions and stop overfishing within the next 2 to 3 decades. If we do that, the oceans will stay well mixed. There will still be oxygen in the deep sea. Dead zones will decrease, but we probably won't have any megafauna, but that'll be fine because, you know, mahi-mahi tastes good. And there'll be more mahi-mahi if you don't have big things to eat the mahi-mahi. And you know, we could have massive agriculture and we could live happily ever after. We wouldn't need fish. But if we fail to cap and significantly decrease carbon emissions, even if we stop overfishing and even if we control nutrient runoff, the oceans are going to become acidic as hell. And they're going to be vertically stratified because, you know, warmer water at the surface is harder to mix down to deeper, colder water. We're already measuring in the eastern Pacific a decline in overturn. We're already measuring a decline in upwelling rates. We're already measuring a decrease in nutrient flux to the surface. So, you know, the ocean could become not only acidic, but stratified like the Black Sea. And, you know, the Black Sea used to have, before the Russian agricultural revolution, used to have a prospering fishery in surface waters, but, you know, it was stratified and not a very good place for people in deeper water. So we'd have dominance of opportunistic species in the surface, as in the first scenario. We have the demise of calcified organisms, including corals, mollusks, and major groups of plankton like coccolithophores. Think about the fact that coccolithophores made the chalk of the White Cliffs of Dover. They're the most productive primary producers in temperate and warm, sort of low polar oceans. They will be replaced by something, undoubtedly a cyanobacteria or something, and that will be good, bad, or indifferent, who knows, but it's an uncontrolled experiment. There is lots of experimental data to show that coccolithophores just give up the ghost when the pH drops to levels it will arrive at. The ocean will arrive at that pH in 50 to 100 years, and there'll be anoxia below the thermocline, and it's starting to sound like the Permian. And then if we just don't do anything, which is highly likely, there will be extreme nutrient enrichment on top of all the other things that I said, and so we'll have dead zones surrounding the land masses of the world. Maybe the dead zones will move into the open ocean. The coastal waters will be too toxic for agriculture. You don't really want to eat something, an oyster that was raised in an environment that had dinoflagellate blooms. It would be kind of a gastronomic Russian roulette. Sometimes it's okay and sometimes it isn't.
That was Dr. Jeremy Jackson from the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. Find a link to that complete video in my EcoShock blog, February 25, 2010. At the start of this Radio EcoShock show, I promised you the latest from Andrew Glickson of Australia National University. To get this message out, I'm prepared to commit relative radio suicide by doing the forbidden. I will read out Glickson's most recent scientific paper in its entirety. It's 4 pages. It's scientific, but clear. I'll elaborate a bit afterwards. Good luck. Here we go, as sent to me by email. Climate change as a major geological event. Andrew Glickson, Earth and Paleoclimate Scientist, Australian National University. Major mass extinctions in the history of Earth were related, among other factors, to runaway rise in the level of atmospheric CO2. Peter Ward. We're simply talking about the very life support system of this planet. Joachim Schellenhuber. The release of more than 320 billion tons of carbon, gigatons of carbon, from buried early biospheres, adding more than one half of the original carbon inventory of the atmosphere, around 590 gigatons of carbon, as well as the depletion of vegetation, have triggered a fundamental shift in the state of the atmosphere, raising atmospheric CO2 levels at a rate of 2 parts per million per year, a pace unprecedented in the geological record, with the exception of the effects of CO2 released from craters excavated by large asteroid impacts. The deleterious effects of pollution and deforestation have reached a geological dimension, tracking toward conditions which existed on Earth in the mid-Pliocene about 2.8 billion years ago. Lost all too often in the climate debate is an appreciation of the delicate balance between the physical and chemical state of the atmosphere-ocean-land system and the evolving biosphere, which controls the emergence, survival, and demise of species, including humans. By contrast to Venus, with its thick blanket of CO2 and sulfur dioxide greenhouse atmosphere, exerting extreme pressure, 90 bars at the surface, or Mars, with its thin 0.01 bar CO2 atmosphere, the presence in the Earth's atmosphere of trace concentrations of greenhouse gases, CO2, methane, nitric oxides, ozone, modulates surface temperatures in the range of minus 89 to plus 57.7 degrees Celsius and a mean of 14 degrees Celsius, allowing the presence of liquid water and thereby of life. Forming a thin, breathable veneer only slightly more than 1,000th the diameter of Earth, and evolving both gradually as well as through major perturbations with time, the Earth's atmosphere acts as the lungs of the biosphere, allowing an exchange of carbon gases and oxygen with plants and animals, which in turn affect the atmosphere, for example, through the release of methane and photosynthetic oxygen. CO2 is 28 times more soluble in water than is oxygen. Above critical thresholds, CO2 becomes toxic for certain organisms. Marine organisms are more sensitive to changes in CO2 levels than are terrestrial organisms. Excess CO2 reduces the ability of respiratory pigments to oxygenate tissues and makes body fluids more acidic, thereby hampering the production of carbonate hard parts like shells. Relatively modest but sustained increases in CO2 concentrations hamper the synthesis of proteins, reduce fertilization rates, and produce deformities in calcareous hard parts. The observed pattern of marine extinctions is consistent with hypercapnia, excessive levels of CO2, with related extinction events. When the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere rises above a critical threshold, climate shifts to a different state. Any significant increase in the level of carbon gases triggers powerful feedbacks. These include ice melt, warm water interaction, decline of ice reflection, albedo, and increase in infrared absorption by exposed water. Further release of CO2 from the oceans and from drying and burning vegetation shifts global climate zones towards the poles, warms the oceans, and induces ocean acidification. The essential physics of the infrared absorption emission resonance of greenhouse molecules is indicated by observations in nature and laboratory studies, as portrayed in the relations between atmospheric CO2 and mean global temperature projections. During most of Earth history, the oxygen-poor composition of the atmosphere resulted in dominance of reduced carbon species in the air and the oceans, including methane and carbon monoxide, allowing mainly algae and bacteria to exist in the oceans. It is commonly held that about 0.7 billion years ago, in the wake of the Marinoan glaciation, so-called Snowball Earth, oxygenation of low-temperature water allowed development of new oxygen-binding proteins, and thereby of multicellular animals, followed by the development of a rich variety of organisms, the so-called Cambrian explosion. The present state of the biosphere, allowing survival of large mammals and of humans on the continents, developed when CO2 levels fell below about 500 parts per million some 34 million years ago, the end of the Eocene. At this stage, as well as following warm periods in the Oligocene, around 25 million years ago, and the mid-Miocene, about 15 million years ago, development of the Antarctic ice sheet led to a fundamental change in the global climate regime. About 2.8 million years ago, the mid-Pliocene, the Greenland ice sheet and the Arctic ice sheet began to form, with further decline in global temperatures expressed through glacial-interglacial cycles, regulated by orbital forcing, the Milankovic cycles, with atmospheric CO2 levels oscillating between 180 and 280 parts per million CO2. These conditions allowed the emergence of humans in Africa and their migration all over the world. Recent paleoclimate studies using multiple proxies, such as soil carbonate 13C, alkanones, boron calcium, stomata leaf pores, indicate that the current CO2 level of 388 parts per million and CO2 equivalent level of 460 parts per million, which includes the methane factor, commit us to warming above pre-industrial levels to 3 to 4 degrees Celsius in the tropics and 10 degrees C in polar regions, tracking towards an ice-free Earth. Small human clans post 3 million years ago responded to changing climates through migration within and out of Africa. Homo sapiens emerged during the glacial period preceding the 124,000 years old Eemian interglacial, when temperatures rose by about 1 degree C and sea levels by 6 to 8 meters relative to pre-industrial. The development of agriculture and thereby human civilization had to wait until climate stabilized about 8,000 years ago, when large-scale irrigation along the great river valleys, the Nile, Euphrates, Indus, and Yellow River, became possible. Since the 18th century, mean global temperature has risen by about 0.8 degrees C. Another 0.5 degrees C is masked by industrial-emitted aerosols, like sulfur dioxide. And further rise ensues from current melting of the ice sheets and sea ice. The polar regions, acting as thermostats of the Earth, are the source of the cold air current vortices and the cold ocean currents, such as the Humboldt and California Current, which keep the Earth's overall temperature balance, much as the bloodstream regulates the body's temperature and supply of oxygen. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're reading out a paper called Climate Change as a Geological Event by Dr. Andrew Glickson of the Australian National University. At 4 degrees Celsius, advanced total melting of the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets leads to sea levels tens of meters higher than at present. Further rise of carbon dioxide equivalent above 500 parts per million and mean global temperatures above 4 degrees C can only lead towards greenhouse Earth conditions such as existed during the Cretaceous and early Cainozoic. A rise of atmospheric CO2 concentration triggers feedback effects due to warming, desiccation and burning of vegetation, releasing more CO2. The onset of methane release from the polar bogs and sediments is of major concern. Ice-meltwater interaction proceeds as meltwater melts more ice. Ice loss results in albedo loss, and exposed water absorbs infrared heat, resulting in an amplified feedback cycle. Because CO2 is cumulative, with atmospheric residence time on the scale of centuries to millennia, stabilization of the climate through small incremental reduction in emissions may not be sufficient to avoid runaway climate change and possible tipping points. Climate change is appropriately described as a global oxygenation event, affecting geological carbon deposits as well as the present biosphere. At 2 parts per million per year, the pace of carbon oxidation exceeds the highest recorded geological rate of 0.4 parts per million per year at the Paleocene-Eocene boundary at 55 million years ago, when about 2,000 gigatons of carbon were burnt, triggering an extinction of species. Sea level rise constitutes a critical parameter which reflects all other components of climate change. Since the early 20th century, the rate of sea level rise increased from about 1 millimeter per year to about 3.5 millimeters per year. 1993 to 2009 mean rate of 3.2 millimeters per year, plus or minus 0.4, representing a nearly fourfold increase since the onset of the industrial age. The Earth poles are warming at rates 3 to 4 times faster than low altitudes. The most detailed satellite information available shows that ice sheets in Greenland and western Antarctica are shrinking and in some places are already in runaway melt mode. A new study, using 50 million laser readings from a NASA satellite, calculates changes in the height of the vulnerable but massive ice sheets and found them especially worse at their edges, where warmer water eats away from below. In some parts of Antarctica, ice sheets have been losing 30 feet a year in thickness since 2003. The consequences of open-ended rise in atmospheric CO2 are manifest in the geological record. The world is in a lag period when increasing atmospheric energy is expressed by intense hurricanes, increased pressure at mid-latitude high-pressure zones, and shift of climatic zones towards the poles. With ensuing desertification of temperate zones, i.e. southern Europe, southern Australia, southern Africa, the desiccated forests become prey to firestorms such as in Victoria and California. There is nowhere the 6.5 billion of contemporary humans can go, not even the barren planets, into the study of which space agencies have been pouring more funding than governments allocate for environmental mitigation so far. At 460 parts per million CO2 equivalent, the climate is tracking close to the upper stability limit of the Antarctic ice sheet, defined at approximately 500 parts per million. Once transcended, mitigation measures would hardly be able to reform the cryosphere, that ice world. Humans cannot argue with the physics and chemistry of the atmosphere. What is needed are urgent measures, including 1. Deep cuts in carbon emissions. 2. Parallel fast-track transformation to non-polluting energy utilities, solar, solar thermal, wind, tide, geothermal, hot rocks. 3. Global reforestation and revegetation campaigns, including application of biochar. The alternative does not bear contemplation. Andrew Glickson, Earth and Paleoclimate Scientist, Australian National University. Published in February 2010. In my blog, you'll find a link to a similar version of that paper posted at countercurrents.org on February 22nd. And then there is Peter Ward.
So we're looking at similarly aged coral reefs of Devonian age. There was a big mass extinction among them, and we're trying to figure out why is it that about 360 million years ago, over half the species on Earth rather suddenly died out.
The mechanics of how a changing ocean could kill us off are best described by Dr. Peter Ward in two books, Under a Green Sky and more recently, The Medea Hypothesis. If you only read one book this year, make it Under a Green Sky. Here is Peter Ward from our Radio EcoShock interview in 2009, reiterating the well-known thesis of ocean stagnation.
Try to understand if we had microbes at the major mass extinctions, which seem to correlate to times of very high heat and low oxygen in the oceans. The oceans themselves can lose their oxygen if we have a globally warmed world. If you think about it, what makes wind? Well, wind is simply air masses that are going from warm places to cold places or cold to warm. Let's say we take a globe that has a nice cold pole, as we do now at both ends, and warm in the middle. Well, the warm wants to go to the cold and the cold to the warm, and hence we have beautiful winds and currents and ocean currents. And the whole circulation system is based on this world that is warm at one point and cool somewhere else. If we warm the whole thing relatively, there's no more driving force for currents and no more driving force for big air currents or ocean currents. Things stagnate, and when they stagnate, oxygen goes away. When oxygen disappears, whole different regimes of microbes can take over the oceans, and they seem to have done this in the past.
And finally, just a brief glimpse of how oceans can kill. And then it seems that the ocean somehow could become poisonous, if I understand the theory in your book right. Is that right?
That's absolutely correct. One of the microbial groups that does best when there's no oxygen is a form that produces hydrogen sulfide. And hydrogen sulfide is a great poison. It's that rotten egg smell. And the reason that we react so strongly to it and hate it so much is that it is at very small concentrations, parts per million, can kill we humans. I mean, just the tiniest whiff of this stuff, we're so sensitive to it because we know intuitively or deep in ourselves that this is poison. We cannot deal with this stuff. Stay away, stay away. And yet when we have an ocean with no oxygen at its bottom, and worse, there's no oxygen at its top, these microbes take over, and they can start producing, if they get enough nutrients, they can start producing enormous amounts of hydrogen sulfide. The hydrogen sulfide is a poison to all animals and plants. So it's not a good thing, and the microbes have produced that produce this hydrogen sulfide have left behind little biomarkers, little bits and pieces of their cell walls in these Australian rocks we looked at. We've gotten the same stuff coming from your nice Canadian rocks of the same age. And in fact, we've now found these about 10 or 13 time intervals in the past, all coinciding with rapid global warming through volcanic events.
Of course, all this takes time. None of us will live to see the end of ice on Earth. But all of us may have helped pull the switch that began this vast process. The extinctions have already begun, as Jackson told us. So many scientists have spoken out, warning of a coming mass extinction. I started covering this in 2005 after reading a popular book by Richard Leakey, titled The Sixth Extinction. Just a few weeks ago, we heard similar worries from the eminent biologist Thomas Lovejoy, addressing UNESCO in Paris. In addition to the long-haul changes at the poles and in the ocean currents, there remain two possibilities much closer to us. The first, as Mark Pagani told us earlier, is that existing greenhouse gas emissions may already determine a much hotter world, too hot to support the billions of us we are now. But Andrew Glickson hopes we may survive, perhaps even evolving, through the climate challenge.
And I have a particular interest in the behavior and the fate of these early humans surviving during some of the sharpest ice ages, glaciation, deglaciations that have existed, to the extent of temperatures rising many degrees over very short time periods. It's possible that the intelligence, the high intelligence of humans, has greatly benefited from the fact that they had to survive such fluctuations, and this gives us some hope. It gives us some hope that our species is possibly more capable than perhaps some other species to adapt to extreme variations. But of course, civilization is something else again.
Earth's past is littered with examples of extreme and abrupt climate change. On the U.S. government NOAA site, we find one event just 11,600 years ago. Ice core records from Greenland show in less than a decade there was a sudden warming of around 15 degrees Celsius, or 27 degrees Fahrenheit, of the annual mean temperature. At the same time, a doubling of annual precipitation occurred. Researcher Richard Alley suggests that not only does the climate system have dials that slowly alter climate patterns, there are also switches that can suddenly shift climate in dramatic ways. Or how about this one, as described by Joe Rome? UK Met Office, catastrophic climate change 13 to 18 degrees Fahrenheit over most of the US and 27 degrees Fahrenheit in the Arctic could happen in 50 years, end quote. The present and developing extinction is an open secret. The impending disaster, known so well by biologists, physicists, paleoclimatologists, ocean specialists, it's not part of the general social mind. The message has not reached the public. Without any memory of such an event, do we lack the inner capability to comprehend it? We need a way to process this kind of super information beyond more data or entertainment, right into personal awareness, into that deep biological core where action to save ourselves originates. We are not there yet. I'm Alex Smith, and this has been Radio EcoShock. Get all our past programs as free MP3 downloads at ecoshock.org. I'm sorry if I damaged your day.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org. Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.